Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Eric Hutchinson, who is a professor of classics at Hillsdale College. He's going to talk mostly about a course that he's developed at Hillsdale. He's teaching him. Actually, Eric, you didn't develop this course. Someone else did about, 70 years ago. But
right.
we'll hear about that. But also, I want to mention a book that Eric had come out last summer. It's called On the Law of Nature, a Demonstrative Method. And before we get to the course, Eric, first of all, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and why don't you tell us, what is the book, On the Law of Nature? That's a small subject, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so the book is a translation of a treatise on the natural law that was first published in 1562 by a Danish humanist and Lutheran. He had been a student of Philip Melanchthon's in Wittenberg, and then returned to Copenhagen, where he was something of an intellectual star in his own day, and wrote pretty voluminously on a lot of different topics, mostly in the fields of theology, biblical commentary and exegesis, homiletics, moral philosophy. This treatise is a fairly brief investigation of the law of nature and its harmony with the Decalogue. So the coherence between, he believes, between what we can know by nature and reason and the content or the principles of the Ten Commandments.
I'm going to say it again, On the Law of Nature, a Demonstrative Method. It came out, I see, last May. Very, very good. Well, that's the kind of book that you say it's heavily annotated, edited and annotated and translated.
Right.
The kind of book that requires you to go very deeply into broad erudition. That leads into the course that you're teaching. This is a course you're teaching with a modest title, again, Fate and the Individual in European Literature. And your team teaching it with another Hillsdale instructor, Adam Carrington.
Correct.
Well, where did you get this course?
So I guess we could say, approximately, I got it from a few folks who have been teaching it at the University of Oklahoma. So approximately, I got it from I got the idea of doing it, you know, in real life from a few folks who are teaching it at the University of Oklahoma. Ultimately, it comes from the poet W.H. Auden, and so I knew of the existence of the course. There was a syllabus from it that circulated on the internet several years ago that somebody had pulled out of the archives at the University of Michigan, which is where the course was taught. But I'd never thought of actually attempting it until I was corresponding with Kyle Harper, who's the provost at Oklahoma and has written for you all from time to time. We were corresponding a little bit about, we discovered that we had a sort of mutual love for Auden's poetry, and he happened to mention that he was doing this class with a couple of other people, and I thought, wait, are you serious? Can you send me the syllabus that you use for it, and so on and so forth? So he did, and I took a look at it.
Let's go back for a second. So W.H. Auden, a famous, renowned poet, mid-20th century poet, mm-hmm. English poet. He ends up at the University of Michigan. So he came over here before the war started, I gather.
Right around the beginning of World War II. Mm-hmm.
And he ends up as a visiting professor at the University of Michigan, and he teaches a humanities course
right
there. And I did notice a couple of years ago the syllabus that he used surfaced, and it was crazy. The syllabus was insane. It had 6,000 pages. Most of it poetry, correct? I mean, he had them read all of Dante, all the Divine Comedy. He had them read the Ancients. I actually read somewhere that he included 9 operas on
there are several opera libretti, a couple by Mozart, a few by Wagner, one by Verdi, Beethoven's Fidelio. There are several opera libretti on the syllabus, and apparently there are a couple of really interesting essays that include not of his, of former students of his that include reminiscences about the class. And he would bring, he would bring records into class and play, bits of these operas from time to time. He wasn't really, he'd been interested in music for a long time, and the stage plays and that kind of, had written plays before coming to the United States, but had never really been interested in opera until he moved to New York and then developed something of an obsession with it.
I read once actually that the weekly Saturday broadcasts
mm-hmm.
of opera in the mid-century from the Metropolitan Opera, I think Texaco used to sponsor them, but they were listened to regularly by 12 to 15 million people in the United States. This is when the United States had about 160, 170 million people. That they were very, very popular.
Art yeah, can
all
you imagine?
Kinds
I mean,
of people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's about one in 15, one in 20 Americans, adult Americans, in 1950 listen to opera every week. So it's probably not as doesn't sound as burdensome mm-hmm. back then as it does to us today, but I think there were three Wagners on the syllabus, and I can't
right.
imagine too many things farther from the sensibilities or the attention span of a millennial than one of Wagner's German monstrosities, four and a half hours long.
Right.
But I think the Oklahoma guys have kept, I talked to the Oklahoma guys running the course, and I told them that they absolutely must keep Tristan on their syllabus, and they did. They mm-hmm. did. So.
Well, maybe. So we had to split it up over two semesters because we can only teach it as a one credit course. Well, it was a 2 hour course when it was originally taught, but it's an insane amount of work for 2 credit hours. But he did it in 2 hours in one semester. And so we're doing it 1 hour over the course of two semesters. And maybe we'll find a way to get that one in there in the spring, because pretty much everything we're doing in the spring semester is 19th and 20th centuries. So it would, it would work well in there.
Mm-hmm. And I see on your syllabus, you begin with Aeschylus, you all the way back to the Oresteia, and then you jump to Augustine, you have Dante, you do all of the Divine Comedy, Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Oklahoma guys only were doing Inferno.
Yeah, I think they were a bit more creative with, so keeping the theme, and they were free in substituting other works in. As I recall, I may be wrong about this, but I think they read the Odyssey, and I think Milton may have been on there.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
when Adam and I decided to teach it, we thought, okay, let's try to stick as closely to the original syllabus as we can for a couple of reasons. One was that we wanted to do as much as we could to recreate the experience of the original course. And another reason, sort of selfishly on my part, I have something of an obsession with Auden. I'm really fascinated by his poetry and by his prose. And so I wanted to try to figure out why he includes what he includes, and also why he excludes what he excludes, why he doesn't bring in some of the things you might one might have expected. So that was part of it. And another thing that we did to try to recreate the original atmosphere of the course is that one of the things that Auden himself did that terrified students on the very first day of class was to forbid them from taking notes for the semester.
Wait a minute. I tell my students, get your notebooks out, take notes, and you can't do it on a keyboard. Use your hands.
Sure. Yeah. And I absolutely agree with the prohibition of computers and things of that nature in class. But he wouldn't let them take notes. And there are a couple of reasons for that, I think. One of those reasons has to do with, what are perhaps some idiosyncrasies of his, this idea that they couldn't really learn anything from him. They wouldn't learn anything from what he had to say to them, really, but only from their experience of doing the reading and thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was part of it. And I think perhaps another part of it was to remove a barrier from genuine engagement in the class where they, you know, for no ulterior motive whatsoever, you know, is this going to be on the final or am I going to be tested on this? Right. That they would just think about what it is that they were supposed to be doing and think about what it is that they were supposed to be thinking about, you know, sort of for its own sake. And I do think perhaps part of it too may have been to demonstrate to them that they had an untapped capacity for retention that had not been exploited. I mean, he was precocious in terms of his own memory. I think one of the things that he wanted students to realize is even if they weren't quite on his level, they had, you know, substantial abilities in terms of what they would be able to remember if they were forced to. And so one of the only reasons we know in detail what happened in the class is that one of the students who was in it thought, you know, this is insane. He's not, you know, here's this famous critic and poet and he's lecturing to us every week and we can't write any of it down. And this is all going to be, you know, it's all going to be forgotten. And so he decided that after class was over each week, he would go into the empty classroom next door and write down in a notebook everything that he could remember from class. And what he found was that over the course of the semester, his capacity to remember increased. And so by the end, we've got these long transcripts that are almost verbatim of large sections of lectures. And you can tell that it's almost word for word because it sounds exactly like Auden when you read it. And these giant diagrams that he would draw on the board and sort of schematic overviews of the psychological profiles of characters and, you know, works of literature across, you know, 500 years or whatever. And so we've got some really good records of what happened in the class that came simply out of the exercise of the memory of one of the students who was in there. I mean, the memory aspect of it comes out in what he assigned for the final as well, which was to memorize seven cantos of Dante, word for word, in English translation. And the exam was just come in and write them down in a blue book. And so he told them that this is what the final was going to be. And
wow.
He didn't tell them this till the end, though. So I think he probably knew the whole time when he told them they couldn't take notes that it wasn't actually going to be that big of a deal because the, you know, the exam that he gave them was not going to require them to remember anything that he said. But so he tells them, okay, you have to memorize seven cantos of Dante, and they freak out. So that's cruel and unusual, and we can't do it, and it's quite nasty of you to expect us to. And he was just sort of taken aback, according to his students. He didn't think, he was sort of shocked that they would complain that that was too arduous of a task. And so he said, okay, well, how about five? They still were very put out by that. And he said, okay, I'll make you a deal. I have to go to a wedding in California. We're driving across the country. If I can't do it by the time I get out there, I'll call, you know, your representative for the class and cancel the exam. We'll just cancel it. And of course, you know,
of course,
the exam was not canceled. He went to his wedding and they had to do it. But the guy who talks about this in one of these essays says, you know, the first one that he tried to do, it took him, I forget what he said. I think he said it took him a week or 2 weeks working on it every afternoon, all afternoon to get it, because at that point in time, you know, finals were after the Christmas holidays. And so there was a break in between when the course ended and and when exams were. But with each one, it took him less and less time to do it until by the final one, he memorized an entire canto in an afternoon. And then said, you know, decades later, that that's the most valuable assignment I was ever given as a student.
Doesn't that kind of rote memorization destroy a student's creativity?
No. It helps it.
Shouldn't we have let them compose their own poems?
Absolutely not. No, please no. No, I think, yeah, what you find when you do that sort of thing is that you are incorporating these words and ideas into yourself, into your own brain, into your own thinking, so that they become a kind of second nature, a second skin for you. So I thought that was a really interesting idea as well. And so, you know, we're not doing everything exactly as he had done it, but we're trying the...
You're having the students do memorization?
Yes, but not that much. Yeah. So we're all, actually this weekend, we're all getting together and we've all memorized a passage of at least 40 lines from something. So we let them pick you know, any of the works that we read this semester, and Professor Carrington and I are both doing it as well.
You know, I bet when the students go home and they recite something for their families, their parents, parents are going to be mighty impressed. You rattle off 20 lines of Shakespeare, people in the room take notice.
Right. Yeah. And I sent out a request to the students who are in the class asking them to give me some comments on what they, you know, what they discovered in the class that they thought was odd or surprising or what may have been valuable to them in it. And actually, one of the things that one student said was that he had never had to do long form memorization before, and that this assignment has forced him to learn a lot about the practice of memorization and what works for him, and said, you know, that he's looking forward to making a habit of memorizing more in the future. And to me, that's sort of, oh, okay, mission accomplished there, at least
Very
in
good.
one significant respect.
Well, all undergraduates should leave college with a reservoir of great words and phrases and speeches and lines of poetry and descriptions in novels. I mean, this mm-hmm. is sort of part of your formation, as you put it. You absorb these into yourself, and they become part of your sensibility. And these are the great materials. These are what should be the raw ingredients of your taste and your judgment, your discernment
right,
about
I've been,
things.
The passage I'm doing is Gloucester's first speech in Richard III. And it's been really fun to get that all in there. It gives you an opportunity to say, oh, well, let's see some different renditions of this. How have different people done it? What do they emphasize? So there's a, you know, there's a recording of Kenneth Branagh doing it. There's in the BBC series from a few years ago, The Hollow Crown, the Gloucester is played by Benedict Cumberbatch. So there's a version of him giving the speech, you know, so you mm-hmm, see all the mm-hmm. way all these different actors try to bring the words to life. And that's kind of fun too.
Well, let me ask you, I'm going to run through the works in this first semester. You're doing Aeschylus' Oresteia, Augustine's Confessions, Dante, the full Divine Comedy, Shakespeare. You've got four Shakespeares, Richard III, Othello, Hamlet, and The Tempest, then Ben Jonson's Volpone, Pascal's Pensée, Racine's Phèdre. Now, what is the syllabus for the next semester? Run through the works. What do we got?
Next semester, we're doing Moby Dick. We are doing Kierkegaard, Fear and Trembling. We're doing Dostoevsky, the Brothers Karamazov, and we're doing Kafka's Castle. So when we were kind of planning this out, and it's about the same amount, we wanted to keep the amount of reading roughly the same as what it was this semester.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what keeps it where it is. We may find a way still to work in Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell because it's so short.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to do that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
at a outside of class retreat for students who are in the Collegiate Scholars Program, I think we may do Eliot's Family Reunion, which is the last work that Auden included on his syllabus, along with some other material by Melville and Racine that's not on his syllabus, mm-hmm. but is, you know, thematically relevant to what the rest of the course is about.
Well, you're hitting things that all students should know. I mean, everyone who goes to college, and you know, as you grow up and you're living in the West, everyone should read a little Melville, a little Kafka, a little Dostoevsky. Mm-hmm. These are sort of the basics.
And from this semester, again, based on student comments, some of these things were things that many of them had read or at least read parts of, you know, the Confessions or the Agamemnon, the Inferno. Many fewer people had read Purgatorio and Paradiso, of course, than
right.
had read Inferno. But then when you come to things like Ben Jonson, I mean, maybe one or two.
Right.
When you come to Pascal, almost no one had read yeah. any Pascal. And then we just did Racine yesterday. And one student in a history of theater course had read a play by Racine, and that was it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been fun to...
You're filling gaps.
Yeah, to do some of the stuff that they don't actually do elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is a great experiment. I'd love to see the Auden course spread or something like it. spreading to many other campuses. And, you know, Hillsdale, again, you've got a lot of kids, a lot of courses, and a lot of professors who are very much in tune with the approach. But in a lot of campuses, the move in the humanities toward more contemporary materials, more topical social issues or digital humanities, things like this. And the retention of these great works, you know, the works of genius, the works that last the ages, is what we need to give. And I think the kids are hungry for it.
Well, and I can tell you, this has been one of the most rewarding classes I've ever taught, sort of for sheer intellectual stimulation. You know, it's been ages, maybe going back to even when I was just a very young undergraduate, where I encountered some of this stuff for the first time, and some of it, you know, not at all. And I think part of the reason for that is just the sheer gratuitousness of it, because we're not doing it for any other reason than just to do it. You know, it's not, it's sort of outside of my normal field, you know, once we get past Augustine. And we're not doing it for any sort of further motive than the sake of doing it and seeing what we can learn from it, and what we can learn from it together. You know, all the classes we basically run is just as discussions. And I've learned inordinate amount from doing this class, both from Adam, who's I'm teaching it with, and from the students who pick up on things, who notice things that I did not. You know, who put into words something that I hadn't been able to, you know, on my own when I was just reading these things and thinking about them. And it's been just fantastic.
Well, that's good to hear. We're going to wrap it on that high note, and we should thank you for putting this course together, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.